From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The protagonist of Arthur Phillips' new novel, The Song Is You, lives and breathes and lives by music. A song from Chet Baker or Billie Holiday, Coltrane or Clapton, Joe Jackson or the Cranberries can send him reeling. The twist is they are always with him. He has 8,100 iPod. His iPod engulfs his life, and it's a messy life. This hour, On Point, love, life, and magic, the magic of music in the age of the iPod. You can join the conversation. Is your soundtrack always with you now, on your earbuds? Does that change the way we live with music? We're at 1-800-423-800-423-TALK. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Arthur in 2002. His new novel is The Song Is You. Arthur Phillips, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me, Tom.
And also with me in the studio is Tim Riley, writer and music critic and author of Fever, How Rock Transformed Gender. Tim Riley, it's always great to have you here when it comes to music.
Good to be here, Tom.
Arthur Phillips, what a book. You've got your protagonist here, Julian Donahue. He's kind of in midlife. His marriage is a wreck. He and his wife had a very young child that died. He's got his eye on a rising young female musician. And he's got his ear non-stop on music itself. Is this a new kind of cat, Arthur, or not?
Well, you know, it's autobiographical only to the extent that I am generally plugged into my sound machines as I wander around. And I do have a job which allows me to wander around a lot and walk the dogs and roam aimlessly. I call that work. Others may be less convinced.
But this is you? It's not just the song?
No. It's not. It really isn't. I promise.
Okay.
I promise it isn't. But it is my love affair with my iPod, which I do feel very strongly towards my little friend. Is it a new kind of cat? I mean, I've been plugged into my headphones since I was probably 13 or 14 and I first got a Walkman. And I thought, wow, that changes the whole shape of the world.
Yes, but I think I read somewhere you've got your protagonist here with 8,000 tunes on his iPod, and I think you do too, Arthur.
Well, no, it's totally not autobiographical because I'm only up to just short of 7,000 on mine.
Oh, okay, 7,000. Maybe the best thing to do is have you read a little bit from it, and then Tim, we'll jump in here because we want to sort of consider this story of a man who is obsessed with music. Who is always thinking in terms of tracks and cuts and playlists and what's coming up on his iPod shuffle as he's living through his life. And it mounts up into something that at some kind of meta level feels new to me. You're kind of, Arthur, with your first book, Prague, you were looking back on the time when newly opened Eastern Europe was so hip and kind of the new horizon here. You're kind of a zeitgeist guy. So I figure if you're going deep on, you know, iPod enthrallment, maybe it's a good time to talk about it. Would you read some for us?
If I were a zeitgeist kind of guy, then the last book, which was all about Victorian ghosts, would have been
a bit of a throwback zeitgeist, isn't it? Yeah. Point made. And that in Egypt.
Right.
Okay.
You
have been a zeitgeist guy.
I've come in and out of focus now and again.
Read for us, just to give people a sense of Julian's relationship with music in a tangled life. And listeners, I hope you're thinking, as we do this, about the music in your life and how it may have come to, I don't know, invade, surround, color, imbue your life via the iPod, maybe like never before. Give us a read. This is almost right from the top, Arthur.
Julian Donahue's generation were the pioneers of portable headphone music. And he began carrying with him everywhere the soundtrack to his days when he was 15. When he was 23 and new to New York City, he roamed the Brooklyn Heights promenade, claimed it as his discovery, colonized it with his hours and his Walkman. He fell in love with Manhattan's skyline, like a first-time brothel guest falling for a seasoned professional. He mused over her reflections in the black East River at dusk, dawn, or darkest night, and each haloed light in a tower or strung along the jeweled and sprawling spider legs of the Brooklyn Bridge's spans, hinted at some meaning, which could be understood only when made audible by music and encoded in lyrics. Play on, Walkman, on, rewind, and give me excess of it. Late in the evening of the day he completed his first job, directing a television commercial, Julian sat in the fall air and he listened to Dean Villerman on his Walkman, stared at Manhattan, and inhaled as if he'd just surfaced from a deep dive, and he had the sensation that he might never be so happy again as long as he lived. This quake of joy, inspiring and crippling, was a longing. But longing for what? True love? A wife? Wealth? Music was not so specific as that. Love was in most of these potent songs, of course, but they, the music, the light, the season, implied more than this, because, treacherously, Julian was swelling only with longing for longing. He felt his nerves open and turn to the world like sunflowers on the beach. His body strained forward, but independent of any goal, though he did not know it for many years to come, until he proved it. Because years later, when he had captured all that, love, wife, home, success, child, still he longed, just the same, when he listened to those same songs, now on a portable CD player, easily repeated without the moodicidal interruption of rewinding, turning spindles, wheezing as batteries failed. He felt it all again. He pressed play, and he longed still. When he was first married, Julian worried how he would feel about particular songs if his marriage should expire prematurely, in Rachel's death or her infidelity. Yeah, he imagined it before he knew it, perhaps imagined it so vividly that he caused it. And he prepared himself to lose music for Rachel as the price of love, the ticket torn at admission. He assumed that, whether the marriage worked or not, he would never really find his way back to this music, that old songs would be sucked dry of their promise or too clogged with memory. But no, music lasted longer than anything it inspired. After LPs, cassettes, and CDs, when matrimony was about to decay into its component elements, alimony and acrimony, the songs startled him, and they regained all their previous pre-Rachel meanings, as if they had not only conjured her, but then dismissed her, as if she had been entirely their illusion. He listened to the old songs again years later on that same dark Brooklyn promenade, when every CD he had ever owned sat nestled in that greatest of all human inventions, the iPod, dialed up and yielding to his fingertips' tap. The songs now offered him, in exchange for all he had lost, the sensation that there was something still to long for, still, something still approaching, and all that had gone before was merely prologue to an unimaginably profound love yet to seize him. If there was any difference now, it was only that his hunger for music had become more urgent, less a daily pleasure than a daily craving.
Arthur Phillips reading from his new novel, The Song Is You. And I think right there you get the sense of how deeply embedded the music is in this story, and the way in which iPod brings it in there all the time. Tim Riley, you've read a little bit of this. You're nodding along as Arthur reads from his latest work. You know music inside and out. I mean, here, first of all, he's got Julian, his character, saying, in effect, the world can only be understood when it's captured by or interpreted through music. Until then, it's not exactly real. That's interesting. And then the iPod is the greatest of all human inventions. What do you see bubbling up here, Tim?
Well, he's just captured so beautifully the way what real music fans, people who are, you know, who listen to music not because they want to so much as because they have to, because they feel like some essential piece of themselves is incomplete until they hear that perfect track of the day, and they spend their day searching for that perfect track to listen to that will satisfy that longing that Phillips talks about, which is just such a wonderful, it's such a great theme. It just captures so beautifully our relationship to the art. And what the iPod does is this little gadget that makes the art instantly available at any hour of the day and puts so much more available at our fingertips than we've ever had before that it makes this that much more immediate and that much more satisfying and that much more tantalizingly out of reach at the same time, because I'm sure that Phillips has had this sensation that I have, which is you have 7,000 tracks on your iPod, but you're always wanting the ones that are not there, and I want to make sure and get those on next time, because when I go out, I really want to hear that track by the Pretenders that's on the B-side of the Australian single, you know. And it's just this perfect kind of, and it's also, it operates as this wonderful metaphor for love, for desire, for dreams, for shattered hopes, this central protagonist relationship to the art becomes this very central idea about how a person constructs a world and how they make sense of the world. It's really wonderful writing about music. I mean, the highest compliment I can give as a music critic to this novelist is I can't wait for his book of music criticism to come out, because there are such wonderful descriptions of music all throughout this book, and they really do capture exactly how the fan feels about what they treasure most, which are their favorite private tracks.
And a lot of musical references. We will dive into a bunch of them before this hour is over. But it's not as though, you know, your character or you, Arthur, don't know very well the people who've loved music for a long time. Does it really change it that it's on iPod, the greatest of all human inventions, you have him saying there?
Well, you know, I do think about, I was just reading some other writers about music, novelists specifically, and trying to see how they did it and what they wrote about and how they tried to put that experience of listening in place. And I think it was a Milan Kundera book where someone mentions that they don't like music anymore, but they could imagine that they would have liked it at the time of Bach, when music would have been a single rose in an otherwise vast field of silence or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time when music was something incomparably magical. I have this feeling that Elise Regina is in my head sometimes. When it was something, you know, you didn't hear it. And then suddenly one day you might hear some music and you wouldn't know what it was called. You wouldn't know how to hear it again. You wouldn't know what happened.
You were transported as if by angels, maybe.
Exactly.
And now that rides with us all the time. Arthur Phillips' new novel is The Song Is You. This novel is full of just that thought. Tim Riley's with us as well. Listeners, you can join us. Are you hooked on your iPod? We're at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
April in Paris, chestnuts in blossom, holiday tables under the trees.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about music in our lives in the iPod era and the shifting soundtrack that millions now carry in their ears almost all the time. There's Ella Fitzgerald with April in Paris. Maybe you spin that up on your iPod whenever you're walking down an autumn street or an April street these days. Maybe you've got a soundtrack all the time right now. You can join us. How often, how much of your life are you hooked into an iPod, a playlist, music that goes wherever you go? And from bandstand to LP to Walkman to earbuds, how is technology changing our relationship with music? Arthur Phillips joins us. You may know him from his earlier books, Prague, the big one in 2002, also Egyptologist and Angelica. His new book is This Song Is You. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He joins us from New York. And with me in the studio, our musician, music critic, writer, and friend, Tim Riley, author of Tell Me Why and Fever. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Are we more keyed in to the music when it's with us anytime, everywhere, or does it just become background? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Arthur, I wish you'd talk with us a little bit more about this, the way music becomes electric, becomes excessive. It did then, it does now. There's a key passage out of history in the book where your main character Julia's father has an interaction with Billie Holiday. Let's listen to a little bit of that song, and then you can tell us about that interaction and how it's like and unlike the iPod interactions of his son. Here's Billie Holiday. I cover the waterfront. Okay, Arthur, there's Billy. God bless her. Paint the picture for us of how this, Korean, young soldier in the midst of the Korean War hears this music, the impression it makes on him for life, stand it up against his son, and how his big songs find him and stay with him.
Well, that live recording of Billy is the opening scene of the book. Imagining it being recorded in front of a studio or in front of a live audience mm-hmm. in New York. Mm-hmm. The main character's father is there. He's about to be shipped off to war, and he can't help himself. He shouts out a request, and she takes it, and she sings that, I Cover the Waterfront, and it transports him. And he falls in love with her, but also falls in love with the woman seated next to him in the auditorium and spends a couple days there and then goes off to war where he's wounded. Mm. And then he finds out that this recording, the one we're listening to, was kept and was made into an LP, and it even has him in the background shouting out his request, Waterfront. And it's his heirloom for life. He keeps it forever.
And in fact, if you listen to the actual full cut of this live performance, someone does call out for it, and she responds under her breath.
Yeah. You know, I've had that album for, 15 or 20 years or something, and I've always heard it. And then suddenly one day I wonder if that guy ever knew that they kept his voice there.
But the arrow goes in here in a live performance with everything we all know that means. His son has plenty of time at live performances, but the arrow can go in off the waterfront. I mean, you've got passages here where, you know, he talks about songs coming up on a playlist that just lift him out of his chair. Or here's another one where a song hits him, and his blood is reprioritized at the sound of it in an instant. That's not live. That's maybe off his iPod.
It's true. And the thing about the iPod stuff is we know it. We listen to it 100 times and we know exactly what's going to happen next. And every once in a while something takes us by surprise. But I go back to a lot of the same songs because I know I will get a physical hit from a certain place that I've heard 1,000 times before. And it almost never fails. That Jobim and Regina tune you had playing there for a while, there's a part of it. I invariably get a kind of tingle in my back when I hear a part of that. I remember there's a Sting tune where the Branford Marsalis plays a solo called I Was Brought to My Senses. And for some reason, not only every time do I hear it, am I brought back to the place I was standing in Boston on Charles Street the first time I noticed this effect, mm-hmm. but it has yet to fail me. I get an absolute physical reaction every time this solo kicks in. You can't do that necessarily at a live performance, although it happens sometimes, but when it does happen, it's gone forever. Nothing's gone forever anymore with our music.
It can kick in. It can hit you anytime, any place the earbuds are in, at least. Let's take a call from Pocatello, Idaho, and Brad. Hi, Brad. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Great show.
Thanks.
A great topic. I wanted to chime in about the other place that Dylan or Van Morrison talks about, being transported, or that state of trance, mm-hmm. that when they're in the magic in that moment, it's just magical. And for me, it's all about improvisation, and I'm more and more becoming a snob about my live music. And I want that live experience.
But can you not be transported, brought into that trance when it's in your earpod? That's pretty intimate.
Oh, I absolutely. But if the music was created live, and especially if I was at that experience when it happened, the magic can be recreated for me over and over again.
It's a great point, Brad, and thanks for reminding us about that other place that artists like those talk about. I mean, Tim Riley, Arthur Phillips takes us back first to remember a time when the experience of big-time music, who knows, it might be once in a lifetime that someone, or never, that someone heard a symphony. They might have heard bagpipes or a lute or a didgeridoo, but the whole big time, you know, might be like the heavens cracking open. That's happened for a lot of people in live concerts. Here, our Pocatello, Idaho caller, you know, reminds us of that trance. But the iPod lets that, I mean, this is in a way like the morphine of life, right? This is the kind of ecstatic mind food, soul food of life. And now we can have a sort of continuous drip.
It's the syringe that delivers the drug continuously.
What does that mean when it's always there?
Well, it does a lot of things. I mean, it's easy to, the several different points of view to look at here. One is the cynical point of view, which is we're now deluged with this stuff. And so how do we differentiate and make distinctions? And how do we ever get back to appreciating that Bach music in a field of silence, that flower in the field of silence? Mm-hmm. Of course, we can never recapture that. Just as we can never recapture what it was like to read, you know, chapters of the Dickens novels as they came off the boats. I mean, there's a certain aspect of this historical experience that's forever lost. On the other hand, the iPod is rescuing and cultivating a sense of music history to a larger extent than any other gadget that I can think of, even the old phonograph record, where huge amounts of previously uncollected stuff from music history was discovered. But it's still getting discovered, and you can hear, you can listen to Billie Holiday now on an iPod in higher fidelity than she ever heard her own voice in. All right. And who's to say that that's bad? I mean, so there's a multiplicity of things going on here. And I'm really hesitant to ladle it all with a generalization that says, oh, we're heading off in one direction that means one thing. I think it means many different things at the same time. And I think that some aspects will be lost and other aspects are going to be gained. And we're still sort of figuring that out. The other major theme that we're stumbling onto here is the difference between live performance and recorded performance. And this is something that us critics have thought a lot about, because as we developed a recording technology in the past 50 years, it has become more and more of an art, capturing the ideas in sound and the way sound signifies in greater fidelity, that is completely different and completely removed from the way sound is created in a live context and that direct contact between performer and listener. All right. And so what you're doing is you're talking about two completely different experiences. Okay. The iPod experience is a very intimate experience, a very inward experience. The live performance, which is still not incidentally the way musicians earn most of their money
these days in particular.
These days in particular. Is a very communal experience, all right? So we're talking about two very different things.
Arthur, I want to get you on that, but let me get a call here. Hey, from my hometown, Bloomington, Illinois. Tom, great to have you. Welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I love your show, and nice. and I understand you graduated from U High. I teach at ISU.
it's great to have you, Tom. What do you think?
Well, I
have to correct the record. I went to NCHS, my friend.
Oh, did you?
But that's
okay.
My mom went to U High, but that's too much town talk. What do you know?
I kind of called with a somewhat ill-formed question, but then the quote from Milan Kundera really started to crystallize it for me, and then your quote about it almost like morphine, music becoming like morphine. And my point is about how the iPod seems to be like this engine which is transforming music from an artistic experience to sort of this anesthetic, kind of like this engine of alienation almost. I work at a college campus, and people seem to be like in their little cocoons walking around with their iPods on. And I always feel a little bit disturbed about it. I like to play music, and maybe that's implicated somehow in it. But I always find it like somehow alienating. In a way, how this has, you know, really like lowered a bell jar almost over people.
Once they're in their earbuds, once they're in their private world, and they're in there typically alone.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tom, it's a great point. Let's pick it up. I'll see you down at Luca Grill.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you for calling. Arthur Phillips, how about it? We've got live versus recorded observation from Tim Riley here, and then our caller from Bloomington, Illinois, saying he's worried that the iPod, the greatest invention of all time, as your character has it, can also be an engine of alienation or isolation.
Well, I would argue that, you know, all of those people that he sees wandering around in a daze around campus, they are having artistic experiences. They're having very profound artistic experiences. They're not anesthetized, I wouldn't think. Now, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing that everyone is in an aesthetic frenzy all the time, I don't really know that I'm qualified to answer. I think you can probably have something called iPod abuse, and that you can probably use it too much and miss out on a great many things going on around you. But that's like, you know, God knows, Facebook and Twitter and all the other things that we spend our free thumb moments engaged in. As far as live versus recorded, I don't go to very much live music anymore, simply because it's hard for me to get to it and hard to get out of places, and I don't want to take the risk that I'm going to go hear something that doesn't thrill me, whereas I know exactly where to find the music that does thrill me. It's on my iPod. Yeah. When I do go to hear live music, I'm invariably engrossed by it. I've usually gone to see somebody I love already that I know of because of the iPod, and I'm delighted to go see what they do to me in person, which is different, obviously. And it's surprising every time, and it is strangely more personal to my way of thinking, although less
Let's listen to a point in your book, The Song Is You, where the sort of live and iPod come together. There's a moment where Julian is he's on the trail of this Kate O'Dwyer, this rising wonderful singer. He's enthralled with her. Maybe she's enthralled with him. He's kind of stalking her here, but she's not exactly against that. She's out with her Great Dane for a walk, and he's following along. She's got her iPod in, and she's singing along to this song by The Smiths.
The boy with a thorn in his side, behind the hatred there lies a murderous desire for love. How can they look into my eyes and still they don't believe me? Hear me say those words, still they don't believe me.
Okay, Arthur Phillips, here you set up a scene where it's kind of a hall of mirrors. I mean, she's listening and singing as she listens while he listens to her following along behind her. You get the iPod and the live and everything all at once. What does it open up? Here's live and recorded all in one instant.
He then goes ahead and records her singing to herself and then puts it under her own answering machine back at her house. So she then gets to go home and listen to herself singing a cappella to this song she can't hear anymore, which she then downloads to her computer and keeps as a file on her iTunes.
I got to say, most people I know sound like hell when they sing along to their iPod.
I know I do. But we assume she's a professional singer and she can do something interesting even with that a cappella weirdness. You know, this is sort of how the book started. I had just gotten my first iPod, yeah. A beautiful moment in every young man's life. And I was walking on a beach, and I was alone on the beach. I was quite sure that. I was walking my dog, and I had just put this on, and I was listening to, a New Order tune. And I was really, you know, I was letting rip a full-throated accompaniment. And as I was screaming along with this tune, it suddenly occurred to me that somebody could be standing right behind me. And I actually spun around to see if I was still alone, which I was. But that's actually the seed where the book started.
Let's get a call from Boston. And Adam, hi, Adam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Welcome back.
Thank you. What do you know, Adam?
I'm listening, really interested here in Mr. Phillips' book. I'm one of the afflicted. I walk around the streets of Boston never without my iPod. And
what are you listening to these days, Adam? What's at the top of your playlist? Come on, give us a peek.
Wolf Parade, you know, Broken Social Scene, all kinds of stuff.
Okay. And what do you think?
My question for Mr. Phillips is, you know, with the rise of audiobooks, it occurs to me that you've got an interesting opportunity here with the audiobook on the iPod itself. And I wanted you to talk to your publisher about the opportunities there.
It's a great question, and I wondered it myself, Arthur. Are you setting up for a kind of a singing Kindle experience here?
Well, I have to just go back for 1 second because there was a characteristic moment there in iPod culture where you asked Adam, what's he listening to?
Yeah.
And what's at the top of your list? And I could hear in his voice a desire not to tell you.
What is that? It takes a fig leaf away and shows me
it's not a question of that. It's that it doesn't show you enough. Nobody wants to say the last thing they listen to because that excludes the other 7,000 things on the iPod.
Because they're a pastiche. They're the whole. I got
exactly.
It.
The correct answer to what are you listening to would take 7,000 hours to explain. And so I could hear Adam saying, there's a lot of stuff on there. It's an eclectic collection. I don't want to get into it.
Don't pigeonhole me. You'd have to come over and share one of my buds. But what about it? Maybe you've got a new art form budding here in The Song Is You. Maybe there's an audio version where these tracks run through the voiced text.
Well, we tried a little bit of that. There is an audio book of it, and we were hoping to see if we could sort of string all of the songs that are mentioned into it somehow. What we did instead was we kept a few tracks from a band, a friend of mine called Scrap-O-Matic, based out of Brooklyn and Atlanta, a great blues band, and their music is intermingled in the audiobook, so you can certainly download it at Audible.
Well, we'll go out with a little Audible music right here, the Rolling Stones and Monkey Man. Arthur Phillips' new novel is The Song Is You. He joins us from New York City. Tim Riley is with us right here, author of Fever and Tell Me Why. We're talking about music in our lives in the iPod era. You can join us. What's the playlist of your day? Do you have favorite tracks for the gym, the subway, cooking dinner, chill time? And has the omnipresence of all this music we own changed the role of music in our lives? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point with the Rolling Stones. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point with a little flathead there from Fratelli's. We're talking this hour about music in our lives in the iPod era. Novelist, author Arthur Phillips is with us. His latest is The Song Is You. It's got a musical obsessive right at the heart of it, but it's all turbocharged by the iPod. Music critic Tim Riley joins us as well, author of Fever, How Rock Transformed Gender, and Tell Me Why, a Beatles commentary. You can join the conversation as well. Did you read Arthur Phillips' Prague? Are you surprised to find music and the iPod at the heart of his latest novel? And how does the iPod and the non-stop, what do we call it, the aesthetic frenzy of the music all the time available in your earbuds filter into your life? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's go straight to Chris in Beverly, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What do you know?
Well, iPods. I was given an iPod by one of my kids. I had a bad accident with multiple bone breaks, and I was told to, as I was healing, to swim, and I was trying to do laps, about an hour of them, and it was really boring. And this iPod I could use underwater.
Okay.
So the first thing I did was listen to Rufus Wainwright's Vibrate, which just, I suddenly could do more than I ever did underwater.
So it's not what handles water music, but Rufus Wainwright. That's wonderful.
Right.
So the Rufus, what else do you listen to down to the Bach cantatas?
Yeah, and then I started listening to books.
Even books. Let's stick with the music for a second. Books goes off in a different direction, but how does it change the experience? I mean, it helps you do it. It keeps you occupied. I don't know. Does the water change colors when you listen to a different artist? I mean, seriously, does it change the way you're feeling, thinking as you go?
Yeah, the whole body relaxes, and suddenly you realize you don't need to come up for that gulp of air because you're so relaxed. You just do it better.
That's a great story. I love it. Chris, thank you very much for calling, and we'll think of you with Rufus Wainwright on your 34th lap there. Let's go to Charlotte, North Carolina, and Chase. Chase, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What do you know?
Well, I'm a manager in retail, and as interesting as this can be because it's against policy, I use an iPod myself very frequently, and I actually recommend it among those who work for me because it's I think it affects work ethic very well. I think people get a lot more done when they've got music that helps drive them and helps them to accomplish a lot more.
But when the customer asks, where's the, I don't know, chopper, blender, this and that, and the retail folks got earbuds in, they're in another world.
Well, we never want anyone to be there with the earbuds in when the customers are available, but if they ever step to a back room or regularly when we're stocking off, you know, in different hours when we're not open, that's usually when it's more relevant.
So crank it up and good for business. Tim Riley, what do we call it? The aesthetic frenzy of music all the time. Chris takes it underwater as she swims her laps. And here we've got Chase saying, you know, hey, it's good for work ethic. People are really buzzing.
You know, it's definitely great for boring, repetitive tasks. I mean, for dishwashing, you know, it's just perfect. And I was cleaning my car the other day, and, you know, it's just like it just makes it bearable. That stuff that you have to do that you don't want to do, and if you have music to transport you while you're doing it, you can do two things at once.
But what do you think Bach would have thought of the cantatas being used to swim another lap or wash a dish as
on? Look, Bach would have been great. Bach was the grooviest guy ever. I mean, are you serious? No. And you know, what I love about this novel is that Julian has a very active, he participates actively in the music that he's listening to. So this person who's worried about his college students wandering around like zombies and there's a bell jar dropping over everybody. What this novel portrays is somebody who is actively engaged with the music on a very intimate level and uses all of his ideas about music to make sense of the experience in his life, and that every interaction with every other person gets inflected by music or sets off new ideas about music that he wants to explore. And I love the way this scene that we had of the young singer playing the Smith song, which is actually sort of pointing a song at this person who is she knows only vicariously. It's really what's wonderful. And we do that when we make a mixtape for a lover or a friend. Mm-hmm. We all have our subtextual inferences that are going on, you know, like you really should like this artist and you should get that this song is about you. Even if you don't get it, maybe after a few years it'll sink in.
And come on into this song and it may bring you closer to me. You'll understand me better.
Exactly.
Here's a little Elvis from one track out of Arthur Phillips mentioned in The Song Is You. Elvis with A Little Less Conversation.
Hey! A little less conversation, a little more action, please. All this aggravation is satisfaction in me. A little more bite and a little less spark. A little less fight and a little more spark. And close your mouth and open up your heart. And baby, satisfy me. Satisfy me, baby. Baby, close your eyes and listen to the music.
All right. Thank you, Elvis. We're ready for some action. Arthur, I mean, you've written all through here about how this drives people, how they tap into it and are pushed by the music. What's the difference in a life that's got a soundtrack all the time and a tailored soundtrack all the time where you can dial up the music that may fit the moment or inspire you for the next 5 minutes versus the life pursued in silence?
Well, if it works for you, it's hard for me to see a downside. I have an abiding love for my music collection, which I've been building now for 30 years, and the fact that I can hold all of it and access all of it and pull any of it when I need it or want to add a little, you know, like Tim said, you're doing the dishes, you don't want to be doing the dishes, you put some music on, and suddenly doing the dishes makes you feel alive. I think that's a pretty much unadulterated good. I'm not going to say a word against it. I won't do it.
Let's get a call here from Sam in Marshfield, Massachusetts. Sam, what do you think? Unadulterated good. Take the aesthetic frenzy and run with it all the time.
Hi, Tom. Great topic, a very timely topic in these times.
Yeah.
Speaking both as a long time, I mean back to the radio drama years all the way through the music years of the 50s and the 60s and so forth, and also parenthetically as first program director of one of the major rock FM stations here in Boston,
okay,
old country,
yeah.
I got it, and owner of not just an iPod but also an iPhone with music on it. I love the technology. But, of course, there's a flip side to everything. And sure, the advancing technology has brought us the iPod, unbelievable technology. But also over-researched modern music radio has driven people to the iPod. And the one thing that I think is lost in it, it was alluded to before, mm-hmm. is that, you know, historically, music radio, tended to bring people together. Well, as it's been over-researched into the tighter and tighter little slivers of the pie, it has served to drive people apart. But then you go from what used to be a very communal listening experience to the most individual listening experience you can have, and the only place where communal music listening seems to be happening anymore is in the live concert. And that was also alluded to before.
Right.
So that's the one thing that I think is lost. So
there's both sides of it, Sam, and you clearly know of what you speak. Yeah, absolutely. As Tim Riley says, a lot of angles on this, and we may love some and not love some. You're looking at a downside, even while you've got the thing and use it. Sam, thank you so much. Let me get one more right here from Augusta, Georgia. Maybe another naysayer. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
Enjoy the show.
Thank you. What do you know?
Music throughout my life has basically kept me alive. It's the only thing that keeps me going, my love of music. And I believe that the iPod has commodified music and made it a distraction. Music listening should be something that you sit down and savor and enjoy. And You can't do it walking around with buds in your ear.
Well, why not exactly?
It takes away because you're distracted by whatever you're doing else at the time. It takes away from the experience of sitting down, putting on a record or a CD, preferably a record, and sitting there and giving your full attention to the music and the performance.
And do you think that's just you somehow speaking generationally? Maybe it is possible for a 19 or 29 or 39-year-old to do that. Maybe they've just got a different relationship to the music.
They have, well, yes, they do have a different relationship to the music. Because if you look back at an artist that releases an album, this is a time frame where they are recording something, where they are doing something, and you're taking the whole performance completely. You're taking this 3 months that they've spent in a studio working on whatever as the finished art form. Whereas with iPods, you're picking a song here, you're picking a song there. You're not taking into consideration the time and effort that the artist put into making this work.
And you're jiving along as you buy your, I don't know, Campbell's soup, or pick up, pick up some paper towels at the laundry. What do you say, Tim? There's Sam and John, each with their John in Augusta really doesn't go for it. Sam sees it both ways, but talking about a kind of commoditization, a kind of narrower research of who's going to like what music that the iPod maybe facilitates. I don't know.
Oh, the iPod definitely plays into this. I mean, the fall of radio is one of the giant subtexts of the book, and that's how we used to discover most of our music was on the radio, and it used to be
together.
A much, much more communal experience. And radio really has just, I mean, there's a whole other show on the death of radio, or the death of rock radio, and how music has just gotten, you know, marketed to death and down into 1,000 different niche markets. Mm. But I disagree strongly with this last caller who wants me to light candles and set up a quiet room and listen very respectfully to a pure musical experience. I think there's many, many different kinds of listening that go on now. We've expanded the range of listening. We've expanded the layers. To get on a train ride for more than an hour without an iPod, but that doesn't mean that I don't like setting up a home theater DVD and turning the lights off and listening to a symphony with that quiet, pure experience. Sometimes I don't often. I mean, one of the other ironies is that we approach higher and higher fidelity through the iPod with this private listening experience, and we're also we have less and less leisure time to enjoy that. So we need to take our listening time wherever we can. That's one of the reasons that the iPod's so successful, is that it's so portable. You can take it on your morning commute. You can take it on a walk with your dog. You can do all that kind of stuff with it. But that doesn't rob you of the more private, sacred experience of doing it like our last caller suggested.
Let's listen to another track referenced in Arthur Phillips' The Song Is You. Here's Not Fair, Lily Allen, from her newest album, the British singer, It's Not Me, It's You, 2008. Not Fair, Lily Allen. What's not to love? I'll put that in my earbuds in a nanosecond. Hey, move over, Kate O'Dwyer, Arthur. You've got a new chanteuse every minute here. Scott, in Newport, Rhode Island. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, what do you know?
Well, I have a quote here attributed to a Bishop Joseph Hall from 1574 to 1636.
Okay.
And it seems to speak to Tom Riley's point about the wonder of hearing music for the first time. If you'd like me to read it here.
Oh, yes, please. Let's hear it.
There may be, for aught we know, infinite inventions of art, the possibility whereof we should hardly believe if they were fore-reported to us. Had we lived in some rude and remote part of the world and been told that it is possible that only a hollow piece of wood and the guts of beasts stirred by the fingers of man to make so sweet and melodious a noise, we should have thought it utterly incredible. That now we see and hear it ordinarily done, and we make it no wonder.
Ordinarily done, and he's speaking in the 16th century here,
right.
A long time from earbud time. Wow, there may be infinite inventions of art. Scott, I love that. Thank you very much for sharing that. That's great. And Arthur, now you've got those infinite time. By the time this novel begins to wrap up, what's your sense of how, having gone through it? I mean, you've got love and death and breakup and makeup and all kinds of variations. It's quite a tangle here all through it. I mean, as a novelist, how do you think it changed the course of your narrative to have music writing through it just as if you had earpods plugged into your book?
Well, I wanted to write about music. That's where I started from, and about the love affair with the earbuds. And that carried through to the end, although at the end, maybe more to John's taste in Georgia, it's the music is coming on the stereo, everyone's in a room together, and they're listening to some Bach cello suites. I wanted to write about music, and I had the most wondrous time doing it, and I thought in ways about my love for my iPod that I hadn't thought about explicitly until I started to write them down. I'm reminded of one headphone story. Maybe I'll leave you with that.
Yeah,
I'm very
please.
Fond of When I was in college, my dad took me to the Copley Plaza Hotel in Boston to hear the great Dave McKenna, one of the great jazz pianists of all time.
Yeah.
And he would string, he's mentioned obliquely in the book as a pianist who can string garlands of songs together based on their titles. He'd play All of Me and All the Way and All of You. And he had a headphone in as he was playing. I don't know if anyone has ever seen Dave play, but he used to have a headphone in. And what do you suppose he was listening to as he was playing?
I can only think the singer of that song or something, but I don't know.
That would be the Red Sox game that he was listening
get
to
out of town.
as he was able to play infinitely, perpetually. He could play jazz tune after jazz tune without giving it a thought. And the most beautiful music you can imagine pouring out of that great piano in that beautiful room at the Copley Plaza. He's listening to the Red Sox.
That turns it all around, huh? The Red Sox while the live music goes. Arthur Phillips, the new book is fascinating. It brings musical obsession to a whole new level and very, very up to date. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's just been great having you.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thank you, Tom and Tim.
Arthur Phillips, author of Prague, and now The Song Is You. Tim Riley, what do you say? We'll go out here with a little The Foxy Lady from The Cure, but Net Plus, the aesthetic frenzy in our ears?
Oh, Net, definitely. Big Net Plus, and more big Net Pluses to come, especially if we've got writers like Arthur Phillips out on the job like this.
Tim, you're great, as always, and thanks for being along with your iPod today. We'll all take our iPods out now and tell you later what we were listening to. No, we won't. So, off we go with The Cure. Enjoy your iPods the rest of the day. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast, Pod, at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thank you for joining us. This is On Point.
I'm tired of waiting all my recent time. You got to be out.